welcome to another episode of Three Men and a War Game. I am Paul, also known as Slab Bulkhead, and I've had a pretty good few weeks, which is exciting, and we'll get to that in a minute.
This is Chops, just Chops this week for Potter's sake. And I've been playing games I can't talk about and waiting for the other side.
And I'm Potter, and I literally had nothing clever prepared because I thought Kevin was going to throw me off.
Well, that's the most clever thing you can do is out-clever yourself.
I know.
And that's impressive. So, what's been going on, guys? We didn't get to talk last week because of little Miss Florence.
Holy shit, hurricane!
Through. Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, I ran away. I ran away like a chicken. I got the fuck out of here. I was not dealing with that.
Which is a good plan, except...
I have been through too many hurricanes to stick around.
Yeah, until you left and the next morning the hurricane was going kind of more towards where you were.
With me.
So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. That sucked. I leave and it follows me. I'm internally cursed.
Well, I appreciate you taking it with you, to be perfectly honest with you.
You're welcome. I did it for you.
That's what I figured.
All for you.
That's what I figured. And Chops, you also had a harrowing experience in the past couple days, huh?
Oh, yeah. There was like a big SWAT situation and a shooting a couple office buildings over for me. That was pretty weird.
Yeah, that's not cool.
Yeah, just listening to helicopters and sirens all day. It was pretty great.
Jesus.
Yeah. So if
I don't know if I call that great. that I don't think that's my definition of great.
That is.
Yeah, it was a little scary.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had friends texting me all day. They're like, "You work at a software company in that area? Are you okay?" I'm like, "Not my company. A couple doors down."
Thank God.
But still. Unnerving, yeah. Right?
Yeah, it was unnerving for me, and you know that was just knowing that you were there in that. So
yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah. So we've had some crazy experiences here. Luckily, you know, hurricane turned out to be okay for where Chris and I are in North Carolina. Although,
yep. And I didn't get shot.
Didn't get shot, and nobody he works with got shot, and I think pretty much out of that situation, everybody survived except for the shooter anyway.
That's correct.
So that's good for everybody up there, mostly.
Except for the shooter.
Well.
Fuck that guy.
Fuck that guy is right.
Let's continue.
So anyway, with the end of our traumatic experiences of that, at the end of the hurricane, I did wake up in first thing in the morning, and my phone was buzzing at me to take shelter because of incoming tornadoes, which really sucked because I spent the first hour of my day hiding in my clothes closet with a dog.
Oof, god damn.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into less harrowing yeah. and depressing.
Yeah, let's get into the
what
good
have you
stuff.
Guys been doing for hobby?
Hobbying. I haven't done shit because I ran away like a chicken. So I'm not really sure. I worked on some more Kill Team stuff, just trying to get that painted, which I didn't get done in time.
No.
So that kind of sucked.
You didn't get your wheel?
Did you play any games?
No, I didn't. Because, let's see, the week before the hurricane, I didn't get to go out. I don't remember what I was doing. And then I didn't get to go out because I went to because of the hurricane. So, I have not played in like 2 weeks. It kind of sucks.
I got to play a couple games of Wild West Exodus, which was a lot of fun as far as what I played. Both games went pretty well. I'm kind of getting a handle on my Warrior Nation posse that I've been using because I found out that when you play competitively, it's a single fixed list for your tournament, which is pretty cool because you can ignore the list chicken aspect that War Machine has. So that's getting skipped, which is kind of cool, but you got to kind of have a pretty serious list thought out ahead of time to be competitive, because I guess you kind of want an all comers, because if you skew too far one way, you're not going to be able to compete with everything. Something's going to, you know, fill in that gap, and you don't have a second option like in War Machine. So I've been trying to learn my Warrior Nation, because when we get out and play things in March at major event, I would like to be able to play Wild West Exodus. And as far as hobby goes, I've been painting some of my Wild West Exodus because I want to be able to play them. And I also built a Greater Unclean One, which is super exciting.
Hey, that's a cool model, man.
It is an amazing model. Yeah. It's no joke. It's freaking huge. I mean, it is huge.
You're going to make me have to actually paint my Star
Drake.
That's
the goal.
To
make you work for it.
Oh, I'm pretty sure that's exactly what you had to buy in just to make
yep.
me do it. That's why you bought
yep,
it just
for you.
Me.
I'm helping you out.
Thanks. I appreciate it. There,
how buddy. About you, Chops? What you been hobbying?
Just working on my Eldar very slowly. A lot of the reason I haven't been hobbying is because I picked Horizon Zero Dawn back up, so I've been doing some video gaming rather than the solid hobbying that I had been doing for like months straight. So I'm, you know, giving myself a little video game time.
That's always good.
Yeah. I also got some Malifaux 3E beta under my belt. Having a good time with that. That's about as much as I can say. Other than people who are worried, don't be worried. Third edition is really good.
And it's a beta. Everybody's going to worry and be salty. And, you know, those people are going to leave when they feel salted. And, you know, it's pretty standard.
You can't please everyone, but I'm telling you, it's a improved
game.
People
just hate change is what it comes down to.
Change is not good.
No, but it is good, but it's not good. Yeah.
It is good.
No, I know.
I've seen a lot of salty tears about X-Wing as an example, but when I was at the local game store the other day, happened to be there when they were doing their launch event, and it was all smiles in the room playing X-Wing. People were loving it.
Yeah, it's all the people that don't try it that get salty and bitch. Even seeing it on some of the Season 4 stuff in Guild Ball.
There was a lot of salt yesterday, and I didn't look in to see why.
Esther's?
Was it Esther's?
Esther's, yeah.
Yeah, apparently there was a lot of salt for her yesterday.
There was a ton of salt, but I looked at her and I thought, there's some good shit she's going to be doing.
There is, but, you know, compared to how she used to play, it looks like a Nerf bat. I think we'll have to see the rest of the Brewers, though, before we can say a goddamn thing.
I mean, I'll have to look at her, but I think Esther's needed to be nerfed in the beginning, you know, to begin with. I know Brewers players will probably hate me for saying that because of the fact that they're one of the weaker factions, but Esther's needed to be nerfed. I'm sorry.
Yeah, they needed to bring her down a little bit and the rest of the guild up. They couldn't bring the rest of the guild up and leave her at her power level. So it was self-balancing. She'll be fine.
Yeah. All I know is Ox's update makes me very happy. Very happy.
Yeah, Scalpel's update made me really happy. And there was some salt there. I'm like, what are you guys talking about? Like, she is so good now.
People just don't like the things that change. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. But you know, you can't make everybody happy. People are gonna get bitchy and whiny and.
Yeah, but in terms of future stuff, man, the other side, you guys, we're like, that game is shipping. It's officially shipping now.
Yep. Is it? I missed that. That's awesome.
This week.
Yep.
It ships this week.
Likely we might have it next week
or the week after. Yeah. I give them 3 weeks to get them all out.
Well, they're doing out of United States shipping first, and then they're doing United States shipping. So,
well, they already started shipping
overseas
to the distributors. Yep.
Yeah. And they've talked about doing a public release in October. So we're going to have it.
Good. Yep. So hopefully we'll get some unboxing videos going for that, because I think between all three of us, we have all the factions covered. Who are we missing?
We have the identical two factions.
wait, we both got Gibbering Hordes and King's Army?
Yep. Yeah. Uh-huh.
We might be able to help out one of our newest Patreons, Susan.
Yep.
Thank you, by the way. She's got Cult of the Burning Man, did she not?
Yep, Cult of the Burning Man
okay.
is coming out.
So we have three. So Abyssinia is the only one we won't be able to do a unboxing of.
Yeah, so we have access to that for an unbox. And also, friend of the show, Jim, is getting Burning Man as well. So I think we'll have Burning Man covered. It's just Abyssinia is not covered. So you guys are on your own, friendly listeners.
Yeah, I'll probably end up buying the Abyssinia commander box, but nerd. Not right away. I know.
Degenerate. All those things we call ourselves.
Although, really what it's going to be is I'm going to pick one of the two factions out of the two that I have half the faction of and then buy the rest of the models I want. So,
yeah, I mean, I know I'm going to be picking parts of Abyssinia up just because of the fact that they work with King's Army. So,
yeah, and you'll have the dual commander. And you'll have the dual commander. Yep.
Yep. I love the Abyssinia bikes too. Those are really freaking cool.
Yeah, the Crow Runners are cool too. Like, all their units are cool.
Yeah. They're an awesome looking faction. I'm really impressed with it.
But hey, that's weird, right? Weird miniatures, man. They make good looking stuff.
Yep.
Which is a wonderful thing.
All right, guys. All right. But let's do it. Let's get into the main topic.
Woo, main topic.
So we'll probably talk about the other side a little bit in this main topic, but the main topic for tonight is what makes a good miniatures war game. And I think what we're going to do and the way we're going to break this down, gracious listeners, is by looking at specific aspects and mechanics, breaking down games that do those mechanics well, and talking about what we like and why we like these specific things in our games. Did I get that right, Paul?
Yeah, that's exactly what we want to do. That is exactly it.
All right.
Yeah, so really we're going to look at some major themes that run throughout games, right? So let's get to the first example. And this one's pretty important, and that is resource management. So if you play games, you know that resource management is a pretty simple mechanic most times. It means that you have some type of energy or some type of token that you're keeping track of that allows your models to do things. And your goal is to use those responsibly. Is that a good way to use it? Efficiently?
It's like alcohol. You must use it responsibly.
It's the cause of and solution to all our problems.
Yeah. So we should talk about the granddaddy of resource management games in miniatures war games. And I would be remiss to call that anything but War Machine. I think War Machine is probably what brought that onto the scene.
Absolutely.
I would agree.
Because
I would agree with that.
I mean, especially when you're looking at when War Machine came out back in, what, 04, 05?
Yeah.
You know, its biggest competition at the time was fourth edition Warhammer. 40K.
Fourth edition 40K and seventh edition Fantasy.
Yeah, and there's certainly not resource management in that version of 40K at all.
Nope. There's barely any now.
No, yeah, exactly. So that was kind of a huge thing to be bringing in that concept of how they use focus. All right, and Potter, you've been a longtime War Machine player. Can you explain?
Yep.
How that works in War Machine?
Yeah, so with War Machine, so you have, depending on the system that you play, whether it's War Machine or Hordes, both of them have resource mechanics that you have to utilize. So in War Machine, the Warcasters have, who are your generals, they have what's called focus. And this focus is used to power up all of your Warjacks. It uses to cast your spells, and you have a limited amount that you can get every single turn. So each caster can have a range from 4, I've seen it all the way up to 10. So, that's what you use to cast your spells and your jacks. So you have to plan your turn in accordingly to figure out what you want to do. Do you want to power up your jacks to go in with the jacks killing stuff really heavily, or do you want to power yourself up and maybe your troops? Fury is what Hordes use, and it's kind of the complete opposite of, focus. So Fury is what your beasts generate, and your warlocks, your generals for war hordes, will then leech all of that fury off of them to power themselves up. So it's a little bit more of a yin and yang kind of thing with the resource management, giving each their own individuality, but also at the same time being very similar. And I absolutely, for me, the fury mechanic is probably one of the best mechanics in a resource management game system out there. I absolutely love it.
That encompasses my understanding of War Machine and Hordes, that you rile up beasts and then leech the fury to use it with your warlock, or in War Machine you power up your warjacks with focus and then that lets them do things. You basically spend those tokens to do stuff with the models. Or in Hordes, you do stuff and then gain the tokens on the war beasts and then have to calm them down.
Correct, because with Hordes, it's a little bit of...
risk management.
Yeah, thank you.
Right?
That's the word that I'm looking for. It's also risk management.
Yeah, and they've done a lot of balancing, too, over the years. Like, you know, from first edition with Hordes, where there was almost no... I mean, it was very risk management. I mean, if you slipped up once, you were fucked. They've changed it a lot now, where you know you can lose your beasts, and you aren't going to be as screwed as you were. So like, whereas War Machine, if all your warjacks die, your warcasts are still generating focus. You still get that resource. Whereas in Hordes,
sure.
It used to be, you know, you lose all your beasts, you're screwed. Your resource management's gone.
Yeah, you can't get any fury because you can't leech it.
Right, and now they've changed things up a little bit to make it to where warlocks still generate some fury when all their warbeasts die, but it's not, you know, they don't get everything. So that way that still is that risk.
And also you run the risk of, essentially overheating your warbeasts, right? Too, if you let them rile up too much, you lose control of them.
Yeah, in certain warcasts or warlocks, that's an actual mechanic. Like, you want them to do that. Like, when I used to play Kaya 2 in first edition, and Doomshaper for trolls used to be it as well, too. Like, you didn't care if your guys riled and went crazy. Like, you actually wanted them to do it. It was an actual tactic for you to do.
So, I think the natural extension, and sorry to just, like, break topic and... Let's talk about the evolution a little bit. So I think the easiest way to bridge from War Machine is looking at what I think is, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong again, is a direct descendant of War Machine, and that's Guild Ball. And Guild Ball takes that focus mechanic and changes it a bit, and it in the way that every player that you bring onto your squad generates a certain amount of a resource called influence, and then you are then able to allocate influence to every player on your team up to an amount that is their total possible allocated influence, and then you have to use that influence to do anything but your initial movement. And I think Guild Ball is a brilliant execution of resource management, and maybe one of the top games with it currently.
Well, and it's interesting too, because Guild Ball kind of brings in almost both aspects of War Machine and Hordes in it, right? Because you have more than just influence to manage, right? Because you're also managing your momentum.
Momentum, yeah. Right. I was going to give you that momentum talk.
Yeah, so with momentum, if you're a sports fan, you can visualize this, because as your team does better, the more excited the fans get, right? So and that encourages your team to do better. So each team has kind of a certain play style that their fans like, right? So fishermen, their fans like when they do fancy footwork with the ball. Butchers like seeing their team beat the crap out of each other. Brewers fans like seeing their opponents get knocked down. So all those different ways, those things that the teams like, they're bringing that momentum into the game, which then allows you to do even more than just what influence allowed you to do.
Yeah, and the way I describe this when I'm demoing for people, because I always tell people that this is a two resource game. You're going to be managing two resources primarily, influence and momentum. You use influence to do stuff, and you use momentum to flourish the things that you do. So you're adding flourishes with momentum.
That's actually a really good way of looking at it.
Yeah.
Yep. And that's the way I describe it, and that really it really snaps into place for people when they hear that, and it allows them to effectively spend those two resources. But yeah, I think that the combination of those two resources is really sort of like Guild Ball's secret sauce. It really makes the game really good, because it forces you to like not only have to be clever about how you allocate influence, but then also be very clever about the way in which you activate your models, because you may have positioning that's dependent on, you know, where one model ends up, and you might end up wasting a player's influence if you aren't careful.
See, and that's where Guild Ball ends up being like World of Warcraft, right? Where it's easy to learn but difficult to master, because that's the deepness of the game right there is managing your momentum.
Yep. Agreed.
You know, both in earning it, right? And figuring out how you're going to get it, because there's things that you can't do, like taking shots without momentum. So you need to be able to get it. So you have to manage your influence to then be able to get the momentum that you need to accomplish your goals in the game.
Exactly. And before we bridge into another game, let's talk about why resource management is so important. So we've talked about two games, and we've talked about how those games implement resource management. But the reason that resource management is so good is that if you look at a game, you know, like old 4th edition 40K or 7th edition Warhammer that we were just talking about, there are, you know, overlapping decisions that you need to make. But the thing that resource management adds to a war game is just another level of depth and tactical thinking, because you're not only looking at your soldiers and their position on the battlefield, but you also have to manage this other resource better than your opponent. And that added depth makes the games much more rewarding on subsequent plays, and it gives these games a lot more legs. Like Guild Ball is a single scenario, right? But people play it religiously because that system is impossible to master.
And that's one of the things I wanted to point out, is that with Guild Ball, you have a situation where the game is very thin. If you looked at most other games, it doesn't bring much more objective-wise to the table than, say, old school 40K, right? Old school 40K was basically, all right, eliminate the other guys and shake hands, whereas this one's like, all right, get to 12 points, you know, and really you have two ways of doing that, which is either scoring goals or taking people out. But that resource management is where you get the tactical decision making, and let's face
it's the magic. Yeah, it's the magic. Yeah,
So for Guild Ball, you've talked about the two main resources. I mean, and even now you can throw in kind of a third, which is your plot cards. And especially the way that they've changed them going into season four, they allow you to really manipulate those resources, because it makes it so we're like, someone may be down in that momentum, like me coming in as a butcher player. If I'm going up against fish and the fish player is just playing so well, he's keeping away from me because of his fancy footwork, I can't get in there to beat people up, so which means I'm not getting my momentum. With the plot cards now, I can try and manage that and still be able to give myself enough momentum going into the next phase because of those plot cards. So I mean, it really adds even to that third level of a resource that for Guild Ball now, which is kind of new for this season.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And, you know, even right off the top, you still got one of the aspects that you have to manage with your momentum is that it goes into adding on to your initiative roll for the next turn.
Yeah, I mean, they've really changed plot cards up a lot this season. I was worried how I was going to like them, but I think they've executed it well. I like it now. Granted, I haven't got to play much going into this season, so I will see, especially as I move more back into my butchers. We'll see how it goes.
So now that we've talked about two games that use resources similarly, and I'll say that as the core resource, right? So the core resource in both War Machine and Guild Ball is used for similar things. Influence is a lot like Fury and Focus. But let's talk about a game.
Well, before we do that, let's just, again, and you said this earlier, but I really want to stress this, is that Guild Ball and War Machine are essentially spiritual successors of each other.
I mean, yeah, I think some people will disagree with us, but I think that it's very clear that Guild Ball was heavily influenced by War Machine. The mechanics of Guild Ball are directly informed from War Machine.
Absolutely.
You would be hard pressed to convince me otherwise of that.
Yeah. So, I mean, even the way that they use the bell curve in that game is not identical, but they're running on similar mathematical thinking. But again, I want to bring this back to my, you know, the apple of my eye, which is Malifaux. And so Malifaux uses resource management in an entirely different way. It is completely different because in Malifaux, all of your models have equal activation, you know, aside from your masters, which have one more action they can do. But the resource in this game, and there's two of them, arguably three, but the two resources that you're really going to be keeping track of in this game are your fate cards and your soul stones. And so the reason that Malifaux is so magical with resource management is that the way that you have to understand a little bit about Malifaux if you know nothing, and that's that your core mechanic in this game revolves around a deck of cards, much like a poker deck. It's the same thing, four suits, same amount of cards, two jokers, all of that's the same. And in this game, when you are making a check against something, whether or not that's trying to cast a spell or attack an enemy, you flip a card and you add the value of that card to the value that you are participating in. So if you're making a shot and your shoot skill is six and you flip a three, you've effectively flipped a nine. Now, where we get into resource management in this game is that you have something called a fate hand. Every turn in Malifaux, you generate a hand of six cards. There are some exceptions, but in general, you're going to have six cards. And those cards come out of your deck. And you can do something in Malifaux, which is called cheating fate. And how that works is if you flip a duel and you don't like what you see, at different intervals, depending on the type of duel that you have, you are allowed one opportunity to cheat fate, which is to say replace the value of the card that you flipped with one of the six cards that is in your hand. And this mechanic is like how momentum and influence are sort of the magic of Guild Ball. The fate hand is the magic of Malifaux. That cheating fate is what makes the game. There's part of it in terms of objectives, and that's also one of the shining features of Malifaux. But the core mechanic of being able to cheat fate is so fascinating because, in general, in a standard turn, and Paul, you can come at me if I'm wrong here, but in a standard turn of Malifaux with average crews, you're going to flip 25 cards. And knowing that you're going to flip 25 cards and that you have a hand of six and that you might not have drawn all good cards in your fate hand. As a matter of fact, you probably didn't draw all good cards into your fate hand. You have to be very careful about when you cheat fate. And cheating fate and looking at your opponent's hand and bluffing the contents of your hand, like all of this is critical to playing Malifaux well. And I don't know if you guys want to add anything to that.
No, I mean, I think you covered pretty much everything that I feel like that Malifaux does. I mean, with the card mechanic, I mean, from a resource standpoint, I think you covered it really well.
Well, there's a second resource, and I think you mentioned it real quick, but you also have your soul stones to manage.
Yep, and soul stones are actually a lot like momentum in Guild Ball, in that they do provide mechanical advantages, but they are it's a fixed amount. I shouldn't say a fixed amount and they never recoup, because there are ways that certain crews can get around that and can get more soul stones. But in general, for 90% of the crews, the soul stones you bring are the soul stones you have, and because they are a finite resource, that makes it very important how you use
correct.
Them.
It's not refilling every turn like in War Machine. It's like what correct. You bring is what
yeah,
you
yeah. Get. Your soul stones are yeah, because essentially in the lore, the soul stones are powerful sources of magic, and you have to essentially break them to activate the magic that's in them. So when you use them, they're gone.
And to increase their usefulness as far as resource management, they're also a part of your list building. So depending on how you build your list depends on how many you get to bring.
That's right, because every master brings a certain amount, and any points you don't spend in your crew building, you gain an additional soul stones up to a total cache of seven. So the most that you're going to have going into a game is
right.
seven.
And it's interesting because that ends up being a way, another lever Weird can pull to balance the game.
Yeah, like a summoner might have a low cash, and that is to encourage them to take less models and more stones, because one of the things you can do with soul stones is buy suits, because the suits of the cards in your deck matter when you flip cards for summoning, and you want to force the summoner to have to think about their soul stones to add suits to flips when they're trying to summon models onto the board. And because they're summoning more models, they want to limit the amount that you hire.
Right, which again is all balance, right? Which is the more levers you can pull and adjust things, the more power the company has to massage the meta, I guess would be the way you can say that. But instead of just making it a fixed thing, like adjusting rules or anything like that, they're adjusting it by putting decision making based on this resource into the hands of the player. Right, so it's giving them those options and making the game more fun, because there's that challenge added to it.
Yeah, and so that's again, these resources are entirely different than those in the Guild Ball or War Machine area, in that the way that they're earned and the way that they're spent and what you use them for are completely different, but also again add to that tactical depth of the game, and just add in Malifaux, right, it adds this brilliant layer of bluffing,
right, because you don't know what they've pulled. And the other interesting thing is that you know, it's not entirely random like dice, because if you start seeing that you're pulling all your high cards early on, you know that you're going to start getting screwed by the end of your turn.
Yeah, and there it becomes like some risk management, right? Like you're able to it's luck mitigation, in that you're able to compensate for bad flips with good cards you've drawn into your
right.
hand.
And one of the additional part of that, though, is that you can't math yourself out of a situation, right?
That's
you
correct.
You can't tip your hand so much that there's no way you can fail, which is something you can manage to do in Guild Ball and War Machine. You know, you can't, you know, put up so many buffs that, all right, well, now I'm hitting on twos and, you know, I'm doing damage on, you know, double ones or whatever.
Right, yeah. And again, there's an exception for everything in Malifaux, right?
Well,
there are
exceptions
to that. But for the most part, you're right.
Yeah,
for the most part,
you always have that chance of flipping a black joker, which is going to add zero to your ability, right?
Auto fail, yeah. And also make it so your opponent can't cheat fate, right? Yeah, there's always the outside thing in Malifaux, which, again, is part of its charm.
And that's
me.
The thing about Malifaux. I know this is kind of off topic from resource management, but I guess it's a way the resources affect the game, is that when people are playing Malifaux, you know, there's always people who are going, you know, both players going, oh man, can you believe that? And laughing and lamenting the outcome, which to me is...
Yeah, or like me on Monday where I was lamenting outcomes.
And that'll happen sometimes, and that's part of that resource, but... Seeing the outcome of resource management and random chance, where both players can look at a situation and be like, oh, holy shit, I can't believe that happened. And, you know, it's usually when somebody flips the red joker, which is God almighty powerful, and then right afterwards they flip the black joker. You know, like stuff like that.
Yeah, or like me, I was playing friend of the show John on Monday, and boy, John handed me my ass, and I was just flipping bad, and I, maybe a little bit of a bad sport about it, because by the end of the game I was like, I'm fucking cursed, I can't flip anything.
Oh, I have had those experiences in Malifaux before, and that is just painful.
It was a great game. It was a great game, but man, it was just one of those times where I couldn't flip high cards to save my life.
Oh man, yeah, and we've all had those experiences, and you know, if
oh yeah, yeah, and John's had the opposite against me. He's played my Ulix crew and had the same, like, good God. Well, he's watching me flip 13s every time I need him. But you know, and again, that's more of the beauty of Malifaux, is like that it's not wildly swingy. So when the swings happen, they're especially impactful and memorable.
And that's just it. It's memorable. People remember those experiences, and you know, it's all from that resource, and it being a valid, exciting resource and tactical decision. You know, it forces you to make your decisions.
All right, so I think we've beat resource management to death.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we can let's move on. Well, I mean, that is a very important thing. So the next topic you have lined up is tactical decision making. Paul, why don't you intro that? Tell us what you were thinking.
So with tactical decision making, as I've grown in playing war games, what I've realized is that the more important you can make a decision, the more fun the game is. And it's not ridiculous decisions, but they have to feel important to the player. You know, if it's not an important enough decision, they aren't going to make it. So why have it be a rule? And you need to be able to really force that player to use it. The one of the most important things I can see where there's a tactical decision that didn't play out the way the game designers intended was Icy Sponge and Guild Ball. All right, if you've only come into Guild Ball in the past season or two, you might not even know really what I'm talking about. But you used to be able to decide to keep a player off the pitch and heal them more between turns. And what Steamforged found as they watched people play is that people weren't holding off players from the pitch because their influence was lost. And it was more important for players to have access to that resource of, you know, two or three, possibly four moment or influence each turn than it was to gain back three or four health and holding that player off the pitch.
Yep, I can say in the, three, 4 years I've been playing Guild Ball, I don't think I've ever held someone off the pitch more than one turn that I had to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can still do it. Now there's absolutely no benefit to it. But it was the Steamforged found that it was always better to, or at least players were always making that decision to go for the influence instead of the extra health. So they changed the rule. So this way you just came in back in with half health instead of, you know, increasing by thirds per turn, and said, okay, people don't want to make that decision, so we'll get rid of it. So that's kind of how I view tactical decision making in games, right? Is that it has to be a game that makes you think about what you're doing and have it feel important. And one of the games that I wanted to bring up with good use of tactical decision making is one of Potter's favorites currently, which is Star Wars Legion. Why don't you talk a little bit about tactical decision making in Legion?
So I mean, for me, what's brilliant about the game, is the fog of war mechanic that they got built in. So every turn where you're flipping to see who gets to, or well, not flipping, but you're putting cards out to see who gets to go first, you're getting the opportunity to decide whether you want to try and force your opponent to go second by playing a card that you know will allow you to go first, or do you want to have more activations that you control? So in Legion, in order for you to control the activations you get, you have to play these cards that have higher pip amounts on them, ranging is 1 to 4. And those tokens allow you to put those command tokens on each of your units, so that way you can control who's getting to go in whatever order you want. The rest of your army's tokens go into a bag or into your hand, and you blindly pull them out. So that's that fog of war mechanic. So for me, what really dawned and where I saw the tactical value in Legion is when I started paying attention to my opponents and what cards that they were playing, I can then figure out on a good ratio of what card they're going to play next. And then that allowed me to go, okay, do I want to go first? Do I need this first turn? Or do I want to start controlling what models I activate? And for me, that is a fantastic game design for that tactical decision-making of what I want to do going into my turn. I absolutely love it. And that's one of the reasons why it's my top game right now.
It'd be hard pressed to disagree with that as one of the top examples of tactical decision making. They sort of took the mechanic from bolt action, which is the blind pull. And bolt action, you're pulling out of a bag to see who's going to activate, and then the player has freedom of choice of which model they activate. But now you're basically pulling out of your own bag to see what type of troop you can activate, whether it's your elite troops or your standard troops or whatever. Right. And that combined with, like you said, the ability to play a tactics card that lets you issue orders to specific types so that when it's your turn, you can either choose to activate one that's revealed or pull randomly. It makes those, like, when it comes up to be your turn, it's agonizing, right? Because you're like, oh, do I want to use one of my known activations or do I want to take the risk and pull from the pile and hold off on those? And it's so good. It's just such a good mechanic.
Right, and you're doing so many tactical decisions off of that one decision of what pips you're going to draw, right? Because you're going to decide which card you're going to play. Some of them have extra effects on them, so you're making that decision. You're deciding how many pips you want to play at the risk of going first or knowing that you're not going to go
first. Not having initiative.
Then, once you do that and you know how many units you can activate based on those pips and what the card tells you, then you have to decide, all right, which units do I want to guarantee I can control when they activate? And which ones of these am I going to put into a random bag and hope for the best on? All right, so you're getting three levels, I think that was three, maybe four, levels of tactical decision-making based on that one card at the beginning of the turn. And that's not even getting into deciding what you're going to do with your models when you activate them.
And then there's even another layer on top of that, because not only do these cards allow you to figure out how many orders that you can issue to your guys, they also give your generals special abilities. Like Vader has one where I can go, Vader gets to go, Vader's the only person I can issue orders to, and he gets to, once he activates, he takes two damage, and I get to put his card back into the pile and reactivate him again. And so where you're going, that adds that other one is like, do I want to play this? Or like you're at a point where Skywalker's finally really, really close. And you're like, crap, I really need to play Son of Skywalker now. It's more important for me to play Son of Skywalker than it is for me to get get these extra units over here to go first and or make my opponent, go second. Like, it's more important for me to get Luke that powered up. Like, so there's even that extra layer that you're going into as well, too.
Well, and as I was sitting here thinking about it, you also end up with, if you have two commanders, you have to decide which commander you want to play a card for, because their positioning can determine what people you can give those orders to.
Yeah, and players like me, we really don't have to worry about that because we're only going to ever take one. But Rebels, yeah, especially now that you got Rebels have three, now you have to even go in. It's like, okay, am I going to go Luke Han? Am I going to go Luke Leia? Am I going to go Han Leia? You're even going in that level, and it's like knowing your meta now, what generals are you going to take, which also dictates what command cards are you going to take, because you can only have, seven in a hand?
Yes. Is it
yeah,
seven?
It's
yeah,
seven.
Three and
it's,
one. It, three in the,
it's three,
the
three general cards, three basic, and then standing orders. So you would you,
all right, stop it, you guys. Stop it now. You're making me want to play Legion.
No, keep going. So like even then, now when you're taking two generals, you're losing those standard cards if you want to, and you can take three cards from each general. So now you got six general cards. Each all have special abilities. Downside is you have to now protect that general, because if you lose them, whatever cards that they had not played yet, boom, gone. So
yeah.
So then that's,
man,
that's
so
then
good.
That goes into that more that war machine or a hordes aspect of going, I've got to protect these models. I can't just put them out there to hang to dry, because I'll lose. And at that point, now all you're doing is standing orders, which means you're going last pretty much almost every single time.
Yeah, and you're not even allowing that many people to activate on the standing orders.
Correct, because you only get one unit to activate with standing orders.
Right, and as I was saying too, is that there's only a certain range from your commander model that you can distribute those orders. So if you have Leia in a tight position and Han in a tight position, And you have to decide which one is going to be able to give the orders. And they might not be close enough to be able to give orders to each other. So
Right, and that affects your deployment and all sorts of stuff, right? Like, those decisions just inform inform so much of the mechanics of the game. It's fascinating how deep they made that system with such a simple thing.
Right, and all of those tactical decision-making that we've talked about for Legion is based solely on those initiative cards.
Yep.
Yep. And I'm gonna bring Malifaux into every topic here.
I figured.
Yep.
Oh, it does a lot of things.
And Malifaux, one of my favorite tactical things about Malifaux is in Malifaux, the order of operations is that you flip for deployment and you flip for strats and schemes, and then you hire your crew. So one of the most important and most tactical decisions that you make in Malifaux right away is you look at the objectives that got flipped, and then you get to build your list. So good.
And you also know that your opponent's faction.
You know your opponent's faction, yep. Right. Yeah, so you declare faction, you find out how you're going to deploy and what you're going to be fighting over, and then you hire. And I think that like, there aren't many war games that have that order of operations, and it is fascinating. So that's all I wanted to say. Go play Malifaux. It's a really good game.
I'm going to step in here with my current darling, which is Wild West Exodus.
And I know what you're going to talk about, and it's them cards, boy.
Every card they have in that game is a phenomenal way to make tactical decision making important. Right, the first one I will talk about is your Guts and Glory card, right? Because you have right away, you have those cards that you can look at, and you're deciding how you're going to use them, right? Because you have one half of the card that you can score points off of, and the other half of the card, which as Chops described, Momentum and Guild Ball, it's flourishes, right? It allows you to do just a little bit more than your model may have been able to do without that card, whether it's giving them the ability to do one more extra thing or extra action points or speed them up a little bit. So you're making that decision right there whether you want to use that for
VP
victory points, which can swing a game, or are you going to say, okay, well, I can help accomplish getting victory points from the adventure of the game by using the gut side
or another one of my cards, right? Like, maybe you can't score the one VP, but you can use the other side of it.
Right, exactly. You can use the guts, so you look at it that way, and then you even come down with, okay, it's the end of the turn. I don't think I can score this one next turn. So let me get rid of this card and draw a new one and hope for the best off of that. Right. And then on top of that, you also have your action point cards, to compare Wild West Exodus to Malifaux, because in Malifaux, every model gets two actions, masters get three. Okay. So you always know when a model activates, how much they're going to be able to do. In Wild West Exodus, that is not the case. It's random, right? You draw your card. You might get a one, you might get a two, you might get a three, all the way up to five. There's one five card. So it's random. So you don't know how much they're going to be able to do. Granted, certain models have a limit on how many actions they can do, but you can augment those actions with those action points as well. Right, so it doesn't necessarily have to be, okay, well, I'm going to attack three times. You might only be able to attack once, but you're going to be able to make it a stronger attack. Right, so you got to decide what card you flip, how many action points you're going to have, and who can take most advantage of it. So you might have somebody that you need to get out of a tight situation, but you might flip an action point card that is less than you thought then they'll be able to use to get out of their situation. And then you're faced with, okay, do I activate them anyway with the logic that they might not be able to get as much done? Or do I wait and hope for the best?
And I think the inverse of that is fascinating too, because like you've only got 1-5 action point card, and maybe you flip that and you're looking at your boss like, oh shit, I need to use this 5 action point card on my boss right now, mm-hmm. even though I don't want to activate him so that I can get the most out of him this turn, because you're not going to draw the 5 every turn, right? It's like not a thing you're always going to see, and you need to take advantage of it when you flip it. And like, that's fucking fascinating.
Yep. It is. I had that happen in the game that I played over the weekend, where my boss was in a tough spot. If she didn't get to go first, she was going to get eaten alive. But if she got to go first, she had lots of targets that she was going to likely tear through. And it came down to every tactical decision making. We drew initiative. I won initiative. My opponent had a card that allowed them to steal it from me. So they played that. I had a card that allowed me to steal it back. So I was 100% confident that I was going to go first. And then when I flipped my action card, it was a 5. So, yeah, so then at that point, I looked at it and said, all right, Walk's Looking is going to start tearing through things. So
and that's
with that,
what she did.
And so every single one of my attacks was able to be a super strong attack, which was absolutely ridiculous. And she melted 5 other models off the table in her one activation. So all of that tactical decision making right there. Now, had I flipped a 1 or a 2, I might not have been able to activate her, or I might have tried to save her and hope for the best.
God, so, she's such a jerk.
She's amazing. I love her. So, I mean, that's Wild West Exodus with some tactical decision-making in there.
And then I want to give a little bit of love to Games Workshop here, because Games Workshop, in terms of their games, tactical decision-making is really what their games are fundamentally about in terms of where you deploy. And in 40K, as a specific example, the only resource you get to manage is your command points, but your command points are also your main lever for tactical decision making. It's when to use certain stratagems to give you the most advantage out of those command points that you have. And I just wanted to spell out that the command points in the stratagem system in 40K is what sort of separates it from other war games right now. That's what's giving it its tactical decision making, and that's why 8th edition 40K is so popular.
Yep. And now that's even gone further into now, you know, Age of Sigmar 2.0, because they've added that same level in there. You know, now it makes sense for you to bring more heroes in your list than just your general, because of those tactical decision makings you can make with those command points. I agree. I think 8th edition, even though I'm a big 4th edition fanboy for 40K, it's where I started playing. Well, 3rd edition is where I started, but 4th edition is where I fell in love. I will say 8th edition or 8th Sigmar and the current edition of 40K are the best editions of both those games that they've ever been right now. They're both fantastic.
And it's primarily for that the tactical gameplay. I think that's what they get right.
It finally added another level to those games outside of just throwing dice and capturing objectives. You know, that's where
just like smashing models together.
And that's where 7th edition, like, although 7th edition reeled me back into 40K because of its theme list, you know, and then also the tactical objectives that they had, because that wasn't something that was there in 4th edition, you know, going out and grabbing point standing and things like that. So that was another level that they added to it I really enjoyed. And you had, you know, your missions now had different deployments, different objectives.
And also, before we get flamed, I don't want to talk about – we're not talking about 40K ITS objectives.
Correct.
We're talking about book
Correct.
Objectives. I don't – the stuff that's in the actual rule
yeah,
book.
Yeah. I don't know enough about the ITC to even start talking
for
about
ITC,
it.
ITC, yeah, that's what
like,
I meant.
Yeah, I'm not a 40K tournament player. I never will be a 40K player tournament player ever again. As much as I enjoy 40K in it right now and I'm having fun playing the game, I just won't ever do it because I know what it brings out in me.
Yeah. I was just saying, you know, we're sort of implying that the objectives themselves in 40K are a little vanilla, and I know that's true with like the progressive objectives and things like that in ITC.
The ITC ones.
So I was just clarifying that we're talking about the book stuff.
So I mean, and then also for me, when we're talking about it from a tactical decision making, I would be remiss if I did not bring up Infinity from a tactical decision making standpoint. I think making those decisions from that turn-to-turn basis of whether you're going to shoot and fire at, you know, models that are coming through and stuff, that game, I think, has got a great tactical decision-making process in it.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't get me started on Infinity. I could do a whole episode about literally just the tactical decision-making in Infinity. That game breaks my brain. It's so deep and so good. I mean, it just from, like, how you're going to move, how you're going to issue your orders, like, where you actually move, if you throw smoke grenades, what happens if a smoke grenade goes off the rails and doesn't go where you want it? What do you do with the rest of your orders? Like, do you use fire teams? Do you not? Like, do you take a sectorial army versus a vanilla army so that you can use link teams? Like, holy shit, there's so much tactical decision making in that game. It is just a tactical decision on tactical decision on tactical decision.
Okay, let's slow down for a second, Chops. Why don't you go into some of those things? Because I feel like every time we bring up Infinity, we go, yeah, Infinity's great. It's really cool. None of us have the bandwidth in our brains to be able to play it because we play so many other games, blah, blah, blah. Let's slow down. Let's give Infinity a proper tactical decision because I've already decided that this is going to have to be a multiple episode thing because we're already almost an hour in. So let's give Infinity the love and then we'll go to a part two.
I thought we were pretty deep into this.
Well, with Infinity, one of the things I want to say preamble, because I know we're going to have listeners that are Infinity players, and I am not an Infinity player. I am an Infinity dabbler in that, like, I've played some 150-point games. I've played a 200-point game. I've played one 300-point game. And even then, it wasn't like using all of the rules. So one of the reasons that I gloss over Infinity is that I've read the rule book and I respect the shit out of that game system, but also I gloss over some of the things because I don't feel like I have enough authority over the rules and experience playing the game to talk it up and speak to it other than in the hallowed tones of knowing how good it is and how much fun I have playing that game.
I like the hallowed tones.
So that's my preamble. But what I will say from what I have played of the game, the way that Infinity works is it's an I go you go system, which I typically don't like. I don't like games where I activate all my miniatures and then you activate all your miniatures. But the way that Infinity handles it is very different because in Infinity, all of your models generate what are called orders, and there are different kinds of orders, right? So there's orders that have to be placed on a specific unit, but there's also a general order pool that's drawn, and those orders can be spent however you want. So if you drew six orders and you wanted to use all those on the same guy, you can. And so just right there, that's that talking about tactical decision making and maybe even resource management in orders. So impetuous orders are the orders that you have to use on specific guys, but your regular orders, so regular orders being the ones that you can just use anywhere, do you need to move all your guys up the field? If so, you're going to have to spend those orders across your team. But if you have one badass motherfucker and you want him to do some Rambo shit, you can spend all of your orders on that guy. And that's a huge portion of the tactical decision making. But then another layer of tactical decision making in this gaming is having to know constantly that even though it's your turn, as soon as one of your models declares an action that puts them in the line of sight of your opponent gets to take free shots at your guy. That's like the core mechanic of Infinity is the automatic reaction order, or ARO. And automatic reaction orders basically say as soon as somebody steps in front of your sight line, you can declare an ARO and take a shot at them. Now, when it's your turn, your tactical decision making is it worth the risk stepping out into a sideline and risking an ARO? Because AROs don't fire with the full amount of shots that standard shots do. So you might be able to step out and take more shots, but since it's D20s, you might still get aced. Even though you're stepping out in front of some pleb, you might lose a big guy. So there's that tactical decision making of that risk versus reward and how you spend your orders, if you walk out in front of AROs, what you're going to do. And I think that's the most I want to say right now without letting you guys talk with your you know experience with Infinity and how you feel about it.
You want to go first, Paul?
No, you can do it. Go ahead.
All right. So for me, I think you hit the nail on the head for me for when it came to the AROs. That to me was what I absolutely loved from a tactical decision making standpoint of that game. You know, because of the fact, and then also because of the fact, like you said, it is an I go you go, but because of the ARO being there, it allows you to interact on that on in your player's turn. So you're still getting to do something. You're not just standing there where, like, I started feeling a war machine. Like, I could check out for 20 minutes while my opponent's doing their turn because I don't have to do shit. And then, you know, then I get to come back.
That's the tagline, right? In Infinity, it's always your turn.
Right, exactly. Like, you know, and it for me, the AROs for, you know, just deciding whether, like, all right, cool. And then when it comes down to the line of sight, where you're drawing, like, how am I moving my model so that way I can avoid doing the ARO and still being able to achieve my objective so that way I can get behind this cover, not move in a path where I'm going to get shot by the AROs. You're always thinking, no matter whose turn it is, it is like chess to me in that standpoint, because you're always having to plan. Yeah, you're always having to plan for what your opponent's going to do. You're always having to plan what you're going to do. It's so tactically depth that the AROs in that game bring that in there.
I say to bring some of that tactical depth to bear, we can think about initiative and when you go first versus when your opponent goes first, and then balancing that with what the objective is. So if the objective is to hold a room in Infinity, and you know that you like how the initiative is going to work, your opponent is going to beat you to the room, your tactical decision making now changes, because you're going from, well, I'm not going to be able to secure the room first, so how do I best set myself up to fuck this guy as he comes into the room? Or, you know, like, how do I set up so that I can counter and maybe press other areas on the board and make it harder for them to make it to the room in general. So maybe they can beat me there, but maybe I can make it so that they can't even get to the room effectively. And you have to really like that. And that's all tactical. Like, everything in Infinity is tactical decision making. It is just a like wormhole of depth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100% agree.
Or rabbit hole. Wormhole is wrong. Yeah. Wormhole bends space and makes things shorter. It's a rabbit hole of depth.
And it is. It really is. I mean, that's a fantastic way of describing it, because, I mean, God, Infinity. It just blows my mind. It really does. There's so much good stuff. I mean, and that's when you get into all the special rules in the game and you start looking at how many there are. Yes, they're a pain in the ass to understand them all or to learn them all or to figure out how they all work. But once you get them humming, it's a beautiful thing.
I have a love-hate relationship with all those damn rules, because I love the fact that everything has an individuality. Every piece of gear does something different. It's not that it's copy-pasted. I like that about the game. At the same level, there's so many fucking things to remember in that game. It kills my brain.
Right, like four different types of camouflage. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And it's so, like, the fact is, like, I love it, but at the same time, it's like, why can't they all be the – camouflage means camouflage. It's one thing.
Yeah.
No, it definitely doesn't.
I know. And that's why I say I love it about it, and I hate it about it. It's the same exact – and I'm passionate about both of them at the same exact time.
But the funny – yeah, and if you think about it, it's even funnier because, you know, you have your, like, different levels of camo, like up to TO camo, right? But then you've also got your levels of visors. Like, you have your visors that can see everything versus your visors that might be able to see into smoke but can't necessarily see camo. And, like, holy God,
yeah,
there's just so much going on.
It hurts my brain. And the fact that everything is so different, you can't have all that stuff printed on cards to help it easily, you know, findable for you. You're flipping through this damn book, and It hurts my brain.
But yeah, Infinity is great. Play Infinity.
Oh, it is. Really, the game is fantastic. Beside that point,
find out who your local war corps is and get him to teach you the game. It's so good.
Yeah. If you're in the Raleigh area, Atomic Empire, huge Infinity group out there, please go out there and support.
You know, and adding on to this and tactical decision making, Infinity forces you to use terrain as part of your decision making.
Yes.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Terrain's the third player in Infinity,
and it's even designed in the rule book for one player to have an advantage with terrain because they might not be going first. Right. So there should always be one side of the table that is the obvious advantage. Which most games, that's not a thing. Right. So you have to decide there. Like, do I want the side of the table where I can get my sniper into a fantastic position, or will I go first?
Or do I want to go first?
You know, so right there, I mean, and then just so much terrain, and surprisingly, for as much terrain as there is in the game, it's fairly easy to work with, you know, because...
Yeah, and the game's got a really good flow, too, but I mean, we're off the tactical
rails now. I know, now we're just gushing about it, but Infinity's deserved the discussion. It's deserved it, and we've been putting it off, so...
It has.
Well, I'm okay with that rail.
Yeah, that's all right. It's a very, very good game.
And I don't think we can say enough good things about it, especially considering that none of us play it regularly.
And what I can do is, if you're listening to this show and you're curious about Infinity, just go look up a show called MayaCast. Download a whole bunch of episodes of MayaCast. Kip on MayaCast is one of my favorite podcasters. I don't play Infinity, but I listen to MayaCast because I love those guys. So just that, if you really want to know about Infinity, I'm just going to plug their show because those guys have the Infinity
that
podcast.
Is true. They are wonderful to listen to. I listen to them not quite as regularly as you, Chops, but I do listen to them quite regularly.
Yeah, it's a great show. But yeah, if you want to know about Infinity more than what we talk about and you don't know that's a thing, go listen to that.
All right, so this ended up being a chock full of information on this show, which is fantastic. So we actually have a lot more to talk about on this subject, but if we just keep going, it's going to be a 5-hour episode. And while you guys might want to listen to that, I don't want to edit it.
Yeah. to give the listener some perspective, we wrote down 8 different or 9 different topics to talk about for things that make war games great, and we got through 2 of them in an hour.
We might be a little passionate about this subject.
Yeah, just a little. But I mean, you know, it's what we do. It's what we spend
just a little.
You know, the time in our lives when we're not with our family or working is spent on war game stuff. Let's face it, right?
Yep.
Yeah,
in general, that's correct.
And
90%,
and sometimes
90%
when we're at
that,
work,
yeah,
we might be thinking about war games too. Yeah,
also true. Now,
all right, so yeah, so let's wrap this one up with any final thoughts that we may have. Chops, any?
Malifaux's better. Yeah, Malifaux's better than the game you're playing.
Okay.
Go play Infinity. We talk about it. Go play it. It's a fun game.
Yeah, that too.
Go play Infinity.
Infinity is probably better than the game you're playing, unless it's Malifaux.
Unless it's Legion, because Legion's better than them all. Go play Legion.
I'm gonna bring up what I like to consider Infinity Light, which is Wild West Exodus. It's got a lot of common rules and all that, so you can feel like you can handle a game like Infinity without actually having to handle Infinity.
But they got a 3x3
board. Yeah, Infinity Light's a good way to describe it. It uses less sided dice. It has less
about half of everything on those.
Know,
half the sides of the dice.
But it still gives you tons of tactical depth. I like that. Infinity Light's a good way to describe it.
And its common rules have a card, so you can easily reference them.
Yeah.
Don't play Infinity though. Infinity's great.
You will love it.
Play it.
And you can easily really get a tournament sized army for $80 if you do it right and buy one of the starter boxes.
And they have the best two player starters,
which is
starter boxes.
Oh,
in
hands down. That is true.
And there was something I was going to say about Infinity. Maybe I just said it. I don't know. I forget. So yeah, so those are our final thoughts. One other quick thing is that you may have noticed that we have new music. All right, so I gotta take a moment and plug our friends over at Static Is a City who have provided some music for us. So they wrote up a little thing they wanted me to read, so this way we could get their music and not get sued by, you know, whoever we were stealing music from before. So this is their plugs. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is performed by the now defunct post-hardcore band out of Raleigh, North Carolina, called Static Is a City. And if you ever listen to Drive Like Jay Hugh, these are kind of the spiritual successors to that band. They were together from 2013 to 2016 and featured ex-members of popular 90s bands Dahlia Seed and Mile Marker. Since the end of Static Is a City, some of the members have gone on to other projects. Singer Chris Skelly has gone on to play guitar in the doomy post-punk band Night Battles. Drummer Sean Husick started his own label called Ideas, as well as the post-rock project called Committees. And bassist Channing Azure is currently in the Raleigh doom metal band Bedwin. You can go to Bandcamp, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your music, and check out their new products or their new projects, as well as all the stuff that they made when they were Static Is a City. So we want to thank them for lending us their music to play at the beginning and end of the show. So now to plug ourselves, social media, at whether it's Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, you can find us with the username at Three Men in a War Game. It's the number three, not the words. We do have a Patreon, and we did just get a new Patreon subscriber this week, Susan Miller. Thank you, Susan, for both giving me a place to work for the past 6.5 years and now supporting the podcast. So thank you for that. And yeah, you can find our Patreon. It's just patreon.com/threemeninawargame. It's the full word three. That's where you can find us on Podbean as well. So just want to take that time, plug all that stuff. Did I miss anything?
I wasn't listening. What were you saying?
No, it sounds good.
Okay. All right. Potter zoned out. Good. Now we know why he doesn't read. And all right. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, guys.